You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
And I'm Allison Young. About 10 years ago when I was training, in my teacher training, one of the things that I remembered and I was describing to the students as we were studying, starting with DNA and then mutations and then on to radiation and indigenous people and so on, I told them about watching two people who were in their 60s or 70s and helping them get through the fence as they went to get arrested and how that just, it was so moving to me.
Erin Rogers is my name. I think that when the United States created the first nuclear bomb, they were saying that they were trying to protect U.S. citizens from whatever. And what's happened instead is that they've ended up bombing the U.S. public over and over again and jailing and incarcerating people here and wiping out democracy, which is what they were saying that they wanted to protect. The way that we got started working in this is looking at how many women have breast cancer all over the world and in the United States from the nuclear industry.
Those were voices of people protesting the ongoing testing of nuclear weapons at the Nevada nuclear test site. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. When Congress returns to Washington after the summer recess, they will finish the 2002 budget process, which includes George W. Bush's request for an additional $8.3 billion for Star Wars. The word coming out of Washington, D.C. is that the Democratic Party wants to move $1 or $2 billion from Star Wars into other Pentagon programs, like building more ships or increasing troop pay. This would be what the Democrats would call a cut in Star Wars funding. Not on the agenda of either party is a subject of real cuts in Star Wars research and development funding in 2002. There is always money for nuclear weapons, it seems. How many wind and solar power plants could $8.3 billion build? How many hospital trauma centers could that reopen, staff, and equip? We'll begin with an interview with a former State Department official who will assess how the National Missile Defense Program measures up according to its ostensible defensive purposes. Then we'll hear the soundtrack of a recently declassified 1951 Defense Department internal propaganda film on the nuclear weapons testing program in Nevada, which continues to this day. We'll hear from one of the people downwind of the Nevada test site about the real costs of the nuclear weapons program that are never factored into budget debates on Capitol Hill. The proponents of Star Wars claim its purpose is defensive. Craig Eisendrath, formerly with the U.S. State Department, takes a look at that claim in a conversation with Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio.
I was a Foreign Service officer and handled nuclear affairs and outer space matters. This started in the late 50s into the 60s, and at that point worked a good deal on the Outer Space Treaty, and trying to create a legal regime for space, also trying to create areas of international cooperation in space, and also working, of course, to de-weaponize space. After that, I left the State Department, got a PhD at Harvard, started a college, was a college dean, was executive director of the Pennsylvania Humanities Council. I became a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy in the mid-90s, is what I do now, and I work on intelligence and questions of intelligence and national missile defense, issues like that.
Did you find your work at the State Department pretty rewarding?
I did at the time because we were just moving into outer space. As you know, the Russians put up their first satellites in 57, and we did in early 58. And that was just when I got into the State Department. And so it was a brave new world. It was like Columbus discovering the new world and saying, well, it should belong to King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella. And we said, no, it should be in common. It should not be subject to national appropriation. There shouldn't be weapons of mass destruction. There should be mutual rights of visitation. We tried to map out an entirely different regime from that which had been customary with national states. So it was a very exciting time to be there.
You are co-author of a new book that's going to be available in August.
Yes.
Called The Phantom Defense, America's Pursuit of the Star Wars Illusion.
Yes.
Can you tell me what ideas will be presented in your new book?
Yes. The book really is concerned with three major aspects of the missile question. The first has to do with the technical feasibility of missile defense. And we talk at some length about the problems associated with mid-course defense, with boost phase defense, and with laser defenses. The second aspect is the analysis of the threat. That is, are the threats which are supposedly motivating missile defense really credible? And we talk a good deal about that. And then we talk about the what you might call the geopolitical fallout, that is, how it will create an arms race, how it will destroy the arms control regime, and how it will alienate us from our allies and strain our relations with the Russians and the Chinese. Behind that, of course, we also talk about the history of missile defense, and we do discuss what is the at least the ostensible motivation of people right now in power, which is what we call American unilateralism. That is the idea that the United States should not be tied up by international treaties or obligations, but should be able to act when, where, and how it chooses. And the fact that national missile defense fits in very much with that kind of thinking. Finally, we discuss the fact that one of the major pushes for national missile defense is money. That is the fact that there have been developed over the last 25 years a block of defense contractors, of think tanks, of weapons labs, and of politicians united really by financial gain that have been pushing this. So that in addition to their political ideology of unilateralism, there's also an economic aspect. That's what the book is about.
If we could, let's talk about some of the mechanics of the system itself.
The solidest kind of missile defense that we have is what's called mid-course. That is intercepting the warhead in outer space when it's acting essentially as a ballistic object. The technique that we're using is to impact physically on the warhead, that is to hit it with a physical object. And because of the very high relative speeds, that impact is devastating. That's what occurred in the most recent test. The problem with that entire kind of missile defense, which, by the way, the kind that Clinton was going to build, and is still at the center of the kind that Bush is talking about, is that you can use decoys. And decoys are very inexpensive. That is, they cost somewhere between a hundredth and a thousandth as much as the actual warhead. So they're cheap. They're also technically fairly easy to build. That is, a country which could create an intercontinental ballistic missile can also easily create decoys. So if you create, let's say, 25 or 50 decoys, you have to distinguish between the warhead and the decoy. The problem is that there is no physical way of doing that. Why? Because in outer space, all the objects travel at the same speed. That is, there's no resistance. There's no air resistance. Secondly, if you give the surface of the object the same reflecting characteristics as the warhead, and that is easy to do. You can't distinguish them. That's a problem we've known about probably for 30 years. There's no answer to it. And as Theodore Posel of MIT said, it's not a question of engineering, it's a question of physics. So mid-course defenses are simply not going to happen. They can't work. Now, you get into boost phase. Boost phase tries to eliminate the decoy problem by getting the rocket right as it's launched from the Earth. One, it's going slower, and two, because there is at that point air resistance, decoys are more difficult. They're not impossible, but they're difficult. The problem there is that you have only about 2 minutes to make your mind up of whether to launch or not to launch. That is, before the object gets into outer space. Launching is sometimes a question of war and peace. It cannot be done by a human being in 2 minutes. So what you're doing is you're asking computers to make those decisions. Secondly, boost phase defenses are usually carried by ships. That is, you station the ships off the coast of the particular country where you want to get the missile. First of all, you need a lot of ships because they have to be on alert. So we're talking about a very expensive thing to do. Secondly, it turns out there is no American surface ship which can take a missile large enough to do that job. Why? Because the missile has to hit something that is traveling not only at different speeds, but different accelerations. That is, as the various boosters kick in. It's very difficult to hit something in that situation and requires a fairly large missile to do it. We don't have any American surface ship that can do it. The only vehicle that we have for such a missile is a Trident sub. And a Trident sub, as you know, is a doomsday machine. It launches, you know, a large number of multiple reentry vehicle missiles, you know, several hundred, and is extraordinarily expensive. It's inconceivable that the United States, for instance, would move a Trident sub that close to somebody's shore because it would be totally vulnerable to conventional attack. So it's not a very good option. The third kind of missile defense that the Bush administration is talking about are laser defenses. Laser defenses come in two packages. One are defenses which are launched from planes, that is, within the atmosphere. The problem there is that the plane itself is very vulnerable to conventional anti-aircraft. And secondly, the directed beam, that is, the laser beam itself, rapidly diffuses in the atmosphere with a process which is known as thermal blooming. So it's very difficult, actually, to get close enough to a missile to actually hit it. It's not a very practical system. The other system is equally impractical, and that is essentially orbiting things in outer space. If you think about the fact that the world is 25,000 miles around, it takes a lot of missiles to get close enough to something at the time of launch so it's there so it can hit it. Another possibility, but has its own problems, is stationing missiles in stationary orbits, that is about 23,000 miles up. You can see that's not so easy also from the technical side. The fact is that at this particular time, we have no deployable system. It is not likely that we will have a practical deployable system for another decade or two, if ever. So we're dealing with basically pie in the sky, you might say. We're dealing with things that don't work. And for this, the administration wants to spend somewhere around $150 to possibly $300 or $400 billion. There's already been spent about $131 billion on anti-missile research. And that makes it the most expensive research program in the history of the world on anything. It doesn't work. We haven't gotten anything that works, and there hasn't been any technical breakthroughs of any major note. What we're doing is we're continuing the kind of futile research that characterized the Reagan and Bush periods now into the present with about as little likelihood of success.
How do you see then the July 14th test fitting into the big scope of things?
What it did is it demonstrated that there is a possibility, a reasonable possibility of what they call hitting an object with an object, a bullet with a bullet. You can do it. That doesn't say anything about the decoy problem, which is the major issue. So it solves the fact that you can hit something in mid-course. But let me give you an example of what the problem is. You can see it from another point of view. Let's suppose you have a system, a mid-course system that works 50% of the time. And let's suppose that you station ships or whatever off the coast of China. And let's suppose the Chinese cooperate enough so that you know exactly when they're going off and everything else. And they presently have, as you know, 20 intercontinental ballistic missiles, which are not on full alert. Now, the national intelligence estimate of 2 years ago tells us that if we station missile defenses around China, they will increase their number of missiles from 20 to 200, and they'll place them on full alert. That's an increase of a factor of 10. So that we'll be able to knock 50% of them down, which will mean that 100 will get through. Whereas if we could knock none of them down before, 20 would get through. The question is, are we safer after the system or before? That's the problem we're dealing with. There are essentially two classes of threats. One are coming from what are called rogue states. And the rogue states that the administration has identified are North Korea, Iraq, and Iran. Now, by a rogue state, they mean a state which is irrational enough, apparently, to launch, if they had one, to launch an intercontinental ballistic missile against the United States. Most people, most thoughtful people, think that's just absurd, because these people aren't crazy. And if you launch an intercontinental ballistic missile against the United States, it has a return address on it. You know what I mean? You know where it came from. Because it's a ballistic missile. You simply track it back to its origin. And if you track it back to its origin, let's say in North Korea or Iraq or Iran, you then decimate the country. Nobody's that crazy. No small country is going to attack the United States like that. So that's not a practical possibility of it. Problem number one. Problem number two, let's go state by state. North Korea doesn't have anything that can hit continental United States yet and has stopped testing as of 98 and has said it's not going to test at least through 2003. So it is out of the development business at the moment. It's a very poor country which is racked by famine and has, by the way, 4% of the gross national product of Taiwan. This is the front-runner problem for us. What they're looking for is some way in which they can develop some communication satellites and feed their country. If we're relatively cooperative and encourage, instead of discouraging, their talks with South Korea and their integration into the sort of family of nations, they'll be out of the missile business. So they can be handled diplomatically. We don't need a $150 to a $300 billion missile defense system against North Korea. It's absurd. Let's move on. Iraq. Iraq doesn't have long-range missiles and has no intention of developing them. They've got a missile with a maximum range of 1,300 kilometers, which, by the way, has an average miss rate of about 4 kilometers, so it's not very good. And that's all they want. They want to be able to use things possibly tactically in the Middle East. That's all. That's not a threat against the United States, certainly. Nor, as I say, what they've got very scary, but they have something like that. And it might be worth certainly using some research money to develop what are called theater missiles. That is the ability to knock down relatively short-range missiles. Same, by the way, with Iraq. Iraq is using what's called a Scud. Now, a Scud is just about identical, technically, to what the Germans were using in 1945. That is, it's a single-stage, liquid-fueled, inaccurate rocket. Interestingly enough, you know, we were shooting at these things with Patriot missiles back in the Gulf War, and it initially claimed huge success. We took another look, and our official estimate is that we shot down possibly 12%. That's coming from the GAO. The Israelis think we shot down none of them. Again, it would be worth it to develop effective theater missiles against countries like Iraq and Iran, which might use these in a tactical situation in the Middle East. But we're certainly not talking about national missile defense, and we're not talking about the kind of budget that is going into those things. That's the rogue state issue. If you get into the Chinese, as I said, they've got 20, they could go to 200. We're certainly going to be worse off by ringing them around with defenses than we were before. The Russians, it's even scarier. They have thousands of missiles. We have no possibility of negating their missile force. But what we can do, and what they said they will do, is go off various types of arms control constraints. That is, the strategic reduction treaties, the Treaty on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, the limited test ban, the ABM Treaty of 72. That is, the Russians will simply leave all those constraints, and also the constraints on proliferation and so forth, so that we will be much worse off with the Russians than we were before. Even more disturbing, the Russians, as you know, are economically in terrible shape and are having a terrible time controlling the missile systems that they have. If we take them off these constraints and they start developing more missiles, going into intermediate range stuff, arming ships, going into multiple reentry and so forth, the possibilities of accidental launch will go way up. So the thing we're most worried about will actually appear. Again, we will be worse off with missile defenses than we were before. So the threat business is one, we don't have any threat from the rogue states to speak of, at least in terms of any missile hitting the United States. And the threats that we do have, the real ones from China and Russia, will become worse with a missile defense system.
So how could the administration then be moving forward with this system, if all that's true?
Why are they doing it?
Yeah.
I think they're doing it for a couple of reasons, Mike, and I think it's worth really taking a look at. A missile defense system has the illusion of enabling us to act unilaterally. That is, we don't need anybody else. We don't need to practice diplomacy. We don't need to work within the constraints of international organizations or treaties. We can go it alone. So the administration is knocking itself out, for instance, to break the ABM Treaty of 1972. It's refused to consider the comprehensive test ban. It's refused to, as you know, sign the Kyoto Protocol on climate control. It's refused any agreement on small arms. It was one of three nations, one of three, to abstain on the recent UN resolution on the peaceful uses of outer space. That was the one in November of 2000. That is, we are pulling back from all kinds of international constraints so that we can operate by ourselves. This is the mindset of the administration, particularly people like Rumsfeld, like Condoleezza Rice. People like this think very much unilaterally. They've written, talked this way for years. So I think one thing pushing us towards missile defense is this kind of unilateral ideology. The other is money. There is a huge amount of money involved in these things. As I say, we've already spent $131 billion in research, and we're talking about money that can go anywhere from $150 to $300 billion. Companies involved in this, like Boeing, like TRW, like Lockheed Martin, like Raytheon, are quite willing to share some of that money with people who politically support them. if you look at the Federal Election Commission reports, you can actually see the tens and sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars which some of the major supporters in Congress, in the Senate and the House, have received from these particular arms manufacturers. They also support the various lobbying groups which push this stuff and support the think tanks which support their position, like the Heritage Foundation, for instance. So that they're part of what's driving this system is money. And these lobbying groups have been formed since the mid-70s. And some of the same people are still involved, the same politicians, the same lobbyists, the same think tanks, the same weapons labs, and so forth, are still involved in these groups, just continued now for almost three decades. So I think one of the things driving it is ideology. The other thing that's driving it is money.
It seems, based on your description of the different treaties that we are tearing up, that, in fact, it sounds like the United States is acting like a rogue nation.
We are, in a funny way. You know, as I say, I was involved in my very early years in trying to put together the 1967 Treaty on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. We were the leader in that kind of thing. We were the leader when we got the limited test ban of 63. And now, we're the rogue nation. We're the one who's out. We're the one exception. We're going absolutely against the trend of the world. If you think about the fact that we talk about globalism, we talk about the global economy, the interrelation of countries, and we're going in exactly the opposite direction. We're going in the direction of sovereign, self-contained national states that constituted the world in the 19th century and then was able to give us the most disastrous wars that the world's ever seen in the 20th. That's where we are. We're going in the wrong direction. And I think missile defense is simply an element of that flight from the 21st century.
So having worked yourself on the 67 Outer Space Treaty, do you see both NMD as well as the administration's current push towards what appears to be the control of space, reading the Vision for 2020 document? Do you see that as a direct threat and violation to that treaty?
I do. I think the whole notion of weaponization of space inevitably ends in weapons of mass destruction in outer space, which is a direct violation of the treaty. That's where we're going. And it's a matter of time until we actually start that type of deployment. So, yes, I think it's a direct violation of the spirit and I think inevitably of the letter of that treaty. But it's also in direct contradiction to where the rest of the world wants to go in outer space. They want to demilitarize it totally. And the United States is refusing to do that. We're also, for instance, talking about resuming nuclear testing. Again, breaking the moratorium on testing. We are, I think what you said is very apt, we're becoming the rogue state, the rogue nation.
And what kind of message does that send to the rest of the world? Again, yourself, you helped in the creation of different treaties. When we go along and tear up things like the ABM Treaty and the Outer Space Treaty, why would any country want to enter into a treaty with us?
Very good question. I think it's the answer is they'd be very, very careful. Obviously, they have to deal with us. We're the major military power. But again, consider the fact that the administration has just gone in for a 10.5% increase in our military budget. It's an increase which the increase itself is more than the military budgets of all but five or six countries in the world. We're now at, I think it's $343 billion. It's crazy. And some of the weapons that we're developing are two and three generations, technical generations, more sophisticated than the weapon systems of the people we could possibly fight against. So we are pushing ourselves into a kind of an abstract realm of military dominance, which has nothing to do with the realities of the world, but a lot to do with our own internal politics. I think it's time that the administration begin to listen to what the rest of the world is saying and start becoming a player and not simply an agent of domination.
So what do you see as solutions here within our own country? Because I too find myself almost cheering for, let's say, the Soviets or the Russians to resist this, because I feel like our own populace is totally apathetic and unengaged in the situation.
Yes. Well, one of the problems I think that's occurred, Mike, which is very serious, is that for many years, foreign policy has not been prominent on the American agenda. You look at the last State of the Union speech of President Clinton. I think he spent about a minute and a half on foreign affairs, and the rest of it was domestic. We have to start paying attention to the rest of the world, and we also have to start using some of the traditional means of diplomacy and economic aid rather than automatically going for military solutions. One of the problems, not very well known, is the fact that right now, of the $30 billion of intelligence budget, 27 of it, 26 or 27 of it, is controlled by the military. Most of our intelligence is military intelligence. Military intelligence looks towards military solutions. We don't think about in Congress the cost effectiveness of diplomatic versus military means. For instance, is it more cost-effective to spend $150 to $300 billion to stop the North Koreans or to institute some non-military programs at one-tenth or one-hundredth that cost? We've lost any comparable sense of the use of funds. I was so struck recently by the fact Kofi Annan, you know, the Secretary General of the UN, called on the creation of a fund to stop international AIDS. The United States put up $200 million for that. That was a disgrace. We could have put up 5, we could have put up 10, we could have put up 15. We could have asked the rest of the world to match us and stop this scourge. And instead of this, we put up a token amount and stuck the rest of it into military increases. That's disgraceful. We're losing sight of the main issues in life. And I think it's much to our disgrace, and I can see why you're, you know, cheering the Russians to stop us. I mean, when you can't do it yourself, you want other people to do it. But it's totally understandable. I think what we need to do is really become aware as citizens about the situation, what you're trying to do with your radio broadcasts, write our congressmen, become politically active, and start tipping the scales. Because if we don't, I think the present administration doesn't feel that it's operating with any constraints.
Getting back directly to your book and subjects you cover there, what really sticks out that we haven't talked about?
I think one thing I haven't talked about is the space domination question. There are some people in the United States who feel that the missile business is simply a cover to legitimatize our domination of space. I don't feel that. I feel they are fairly separate strains, but there is some overlap. I think what is very disturbing, particularly in recent months, and you alluded to it, is the attempt by the administration to create total domination of space. This kind of domination, the language of that domination, sounds almost paranoiac and inflated. It has a slightly eerie sound to me. I'm sure it has to you. Again, we have to be very careful in this new area that we cooperate and not dominate, that we work with and not independently of other nations. That move, the move towards cooperation, towards treaty, towards mutual obligation, should be the direction, not unilateral domination. I think the more, again, we focus on that, the more you people in the media can bring those questions to people's attention, the better.
Any last thoughts or words you'd like to share with our listeners?
I would. I'd like to express my enormous appreciation for the work that you folks do, because I think you're the kind of informing that a station like KEXP does is just what this country needs. You know, a lot of television, news broadcasting, a lot of newspapers are, in a sense, shirking their responsibilities. You are not. And I think you deserve our genuine appreciation for the work you're doing.
That was State Department official turned academic Craig Eisenrath speaking with Mike McCormick.
Its strength and mighty power, descending up to heaven to get the brimstone fire. Take warning, my dear brother, be careful how you plan. You're working with the power of God's own holy hand. Atomic power, atomic power, is given by the mighty hand of God. Atomic power, atomic power, was given by the mighty hand.
What we're about to hear is the audio track from one of the recently declassified U.S. nuclear weapons test films. This film was designed to be shown to military personnel who were being assigned to participate in these experiments. Many of the personnel involved in these tests later died of cancer.
Today, whatever you are, whatever you do, wherever you may go, you are a part of atomic warfare. It involves you. Personally, in laboratories and in the field, in little-known places and ways, units of the defense establishment of the United States are learning to work with atomic weapons, learning to strike, learning defense against the effects of atomic weapons. Blast, heat, light, radiation. Military units work continuously with the laboratories of the Atomic Energy Commission and their new weapon ideas. The services devise handling equipment and techniques that are practical and delivery methods that are deadly under any and all conditions of weather and warfare. 13 minutes from now, this airplane is going to drop an atomic bomb on your country. You will see it happen. You will know why. This is the record of military participation on an atomic test. Their objectives, their experiments, their results. Fall 1950. A fierce international war rips through a small country on the North Yellow Sea. Called Korea. Russia has successfully detonated an atomic bomb. Now the Alamogordo of the Ural Valley is a fact. Now more than ever before, the balance of international power rests with atomic energy. With weapons moving steadily from assembly line to stockpile, moving to hidden subterranean vaults, to be stored, ready and waiting. But stockpiling alone in this day and year is not enough. We need to develop and produce a greater number and variety, and possibly even more powerful atomic weapons. Weapons tailored for specialized uses and targets. But like all new ideas and weapons, new atomic bombs, to be useful and practical, must first be tested. The Eniwetok Proving Ground is available. But problems of logistics make it difficult to run more than one test a year at this distant proving ground. What we need is a site closer to our stateside laboratories and available air support. Somewhere in the continental United States, close to home, a stone's throw from lab to testing field. But where? For a long time, as a matter of fact, ever since Trinity, men from Los Alamos had been eyeing the great barren stretches of the Southwest. This region, for the most part, fits the bill. Isolated from centers of population, with favorable winds, with the necessary consistency of soil and formation of Earth's strata below. And so beyond a World War II training base, to the north of an early day Nevada stage stop called Indian Springs, 65 miles north and west of Las Vegas, an atomic range was established. A test site of over 400 square miles of flatbed valleys, mingled with mountains of solid rock, whose veins once colored history with gold and silver. A range remote from civilization, isolated, forgotten as the names of the men who once made their fortunes here. Five times in the pre-dawn hours of January 1951, this long countryside came once more into international focus with Operation Ranger. The test of five atomic bombs. Five successful airdrops that saved the weapons research program months of time, considerable money, and helped Los Alamos prove the radical new idea of small atomic bombs. Soon after Ranger, another use at the Nevada test site was apparent. This was a chance for the military to get more information on the effects of atomic weapons. Vital facts. For what good are atomic weapons without full knowledge of what they can really do? And how we can be protected against their effects? The job of coordinating all military tests and supporting the AEC program at the Nevada site has been assigned to Special Weapons Command, a command that had successfully supported Ranger, and has been in working contact with the AEC, as well as with all military units engaged in atomic research. So today, we in the armed forces have a test range close at hand, and the opportunity to watch and note the effects of the atomic bombs to be detonated on, and in, and above Nevada soil. The armed forces are a full partner in the atomic test for the fall of 1951. Operation Buster Jangle. And to take full advantage of this opportunity, we have a program of experiments and operations to seek out the answers of atomic warfare. Nevada test site. Baker shot, minus one day. For the first time since the era of ZI atomic testing began, we in the military have a full-scale program to answer the questions a military man must know about the basic effects of an atomic explosion on his material and equipment. Along the blast and thermal line, men of the various programs begin the job of placing their test equipment. Precisely arranged at predetermined distance from ground zero, men from the Corps of Engineers set up panels of plastics, paints, and coated fabrics. Samples of various materials, tent cloth, inner and outer clothing, standard and impregnated materials, lucite spheres built to represent a human torso in depth and density, are located at five stations 2,000 to 8,000 feet from ground zero. Film and crystal dosimeters at varying depths within the spheres will measure ionization produced by gamma radiation. Foxholes become a priority project. Open and closed foxholes are spaced from 100 to 2,200 feet from zero. Protected and unprotected structures for the individual soldier are instrumented with film packs, gold foil, and sulfur samples to record gamma and neutron dosage. How and when materials ignite has been tested in many ways, but never before like this. Trays of typical refuse from the forest floor, like leaves, twigs, and pine needles, are to be exposed. We want to find what thermal energy levels will ignite these materials, what effect the blast winds will have on continued burning. What could we expect if enemy bombs were dropped in our forest? Fresh limbs of trees and dry logs should help answer our question. Kirtland Air Force Base, 1600 the afternoon before the first airdrop of the operation. This is not a test of new loading or drop techniques by the Air Force. Every man, every piece of equipment, every technique has been thoroughly proven during many months of practice runs on everything from uncrating the test units to dropping them on test ranges. The original atomic bomb and most of the test units since that time have been detonated on tall steel towers. The towers are costly and take a lot of time to build. On a test operation like Buster Jangle, the gadgets that produce the nuclear explosions are not, in most cases, stockpile bombs. They are laboratory components arranged in new ways. They are test devices placed in a common ballistics case to facilitate aerial drops. For the men of the Special Weapons Command, whose everyday job is working with the problems of handling and delivery of atomic bombs, the precision requirements of Buster Jangle weapons are routine. Kirtland, Baker Day, 0100. Weather and operations briefing for air crews that will be entering their H-hour orbits in Nevada by sunrise. 3 hours from now.
This is a laboratory experiment and not the development testing of a new tactical weapon. Everyone has been thoroughly briefed in possible radiological hazards connected with this mission. Due to the small size of the bomb and the altitude at which you'll be flying, there is very little danger from nuclear radiation, thermal radiation, or blast effect. Flash blindness may be a temporary hazard, but if you wear your goggles as instructed, there will be no danger. Special aircraft, such as the samplers, the trackers, and the terrain surveyors, are more likely to pick up nuclear contamination. Crew members have been specially briefed, and a radiological monitor is on board each aircraft. The aircraft commanders must work in careful coordination with the radiological monitor. Are there any questions? Colonel Ritland?
Gentlemen, the series of tests we are participating in today are unique in that this is only the second time that atomic bombs have been dropped within the continental limits of the United States. The general public and important people in our national structure will be focused on what we are doing. It is therefore particularly important that we produce an excellent mission. Within this operation, we have project officers and aircraft from the United States Navy and 7 Air Force agencies. You have been placed under my operational control so that we can be brought together to accomplish the mission as efficiently as possible. Each crew has been thoroughly trained in the technical aspects of your mission. This morning, we have had a complete operational briefing for today's mission. With the background you have received and the training that you have attained on previous atomic tests, I am confident that you will successfully complete this mission. Now let's go and have a good mission.
First of the air operations to get underway is a C-47. With a job to do only in case the drop plane gets into trouble along the way. If the drop plane has to jettison a unit of fissionable material. These RadSafe, medical, and security men that make up the disaster crew will either land or parachute themselves to recover and protect the unit. The drop plane, Rosebud, is in regular communication with the disaster crew from takeoff to 0 hour.
Hello, Bottleneck. This is Rosebud. Go ahead, Rosebud. Bottleneck, this is Rosebud. Airborne at 0215, proceeding on course. Roger, Rosebud.
For the newspapers of the world, a headline rides in the cold belly of an Air Force bomber. Back at Kirtland, in what is known in the trade here as catfish control, in a very unspectacular routine way, every movement of that newspaper headline and all the other air operations for Buster Jangle are carried out under the eyes of men seasoned by the experience of other atomic tests. Here, the positions of every plane in the area are plotted continuously. In order to ensure airborne test, the same kind of planned position in relation to the burst as the military tests on the ground. In the crisp air of this Nevada sunrise, a news headline is about to be born. A news headline and more. A great deal more. The beginning of a regular schedule of tests to quickly proof test new ideas, to bring more powerful atomic weapons into being as soon as possible, to gain the know-how for the most effective use of atomic weapons, and for full defense against their effects.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
While the rumbling echoes of the Baker blast still race across the Nevada countryside, the first radiological safety monitors leave by helicopter to survey the radiation levels in the target area and around the test setups. As their reports come back that the area is temporarily clear, the military effects people can move into the blast area to recover their samples. The forestry servicemen find the once solid log has become but a shadow, nearly vaporized by the great heat. The trays of forest fuels present an interesting pattern. The paints, plastics, and fabrics have visibly recorded their response to blast and heat. Some of the panel racks lie twisted and broken on the ground, while the sections of material show the effects of thermal burning. Charred and blackened bits of equipment will become valuable data after study by our technicians. Woods and metals of various designs form the basis for a series of experiments on the geometry of thermal burning and their effects on backing material. So the Military Effects Test Group remains a vital cog in the machinery of atomic testing. Charlie Day, H minus 12 hours. We in the Military Biomedical Group begin the task of readying our test animals. These are the standard animals we work with daily in our laboratories. Knowing and working with them, we find that in many ways they are affected very much like humans when exposed to an atomic detonation. So these are our instruments. Perhaps the most delicate of all instrumentation used during atomic tests. We completely anesthetize them for their mission at each hour. Our objective here is to correlate laboratory and field testing and determine the reliability of knowledge gained in our labs. To extend our information on the effects of thermal and nuclear radiation on skin, lungs, blood, the muscular and nervous systems. We can apply this data to the response of humans under similar conditions. At Kirtland, another test device is loaded aboard its special transport, Rosebud. Not a weapon, but a theory. An idea in a ballistics case. Another step in atomic energy enterprise. Perhaps another way to increase the yield of the stuff atomic bombs are made of. The test site ready, the valley where the tall mushrooms grow is left to spend the night before the shot, alone. Operation Buster Jangle. Charlie Day.
How's the shoot check?
Fine.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
Okay, sir.
You gather around for briefing. Major Mitchell will be our rad monitor again today.
Well, men, I would like to remind you that our primary mission this morning is to collect a sample from the cloud for laboratory analysis. The sample that we got on the last mission was very good. Our first penetration is always governed by the cloud dispersion and the velocity of the wind. According to the latest information, it looks like our first pass will be made at HR plus 1.5. Would also like to remind each of you to hand me your film badge at the completion of the mission. That's all, Jim.
Mitch, I'd like to add a thought to your briefing. We have a second mission to perform in this aircraft, and it's a very important one, at least as far as the Air Force is concerned. We're going to prove to everyone who has to do it that they can fly in this stuff and remain in this stuff as long as they observe a few safety precautions. When we are in the area around the cloud, the monitor will be the boss of the aircraft. Fellas, up to now, we've had two very successful sampling missions in our favor. You've all been briefed on the amount of radiation you can get and still be on the safe side. I'd like to assure you that you will never get enough radiation on the inside of this aircraft to give a thought to the consequences. Are there any questions?
Yes, sir. Is the special exit procedure when we get down the same as it was on the last mission?
The exit order will remain the same. Let's try not to touch the outside of the aircraft. And let's get over to the Rad Safe Center as soon as we can. Okay, let's get aboard.
Zero hour. Minus 3 minutes. From the bombardier seat in the drop plane on its final run, we can see our target. 9 miles to the south of ground zero, a C-54, codenamed Starfish, flies a course parallel to the drop plane. This is an airborne laboratory with a staff of doctors to test the effects of the bomb's initial light on the human eye. We want to know how to heal or cause the eye to return to normal after it has looked at a light that for a fleeting moment burns with 50 times the intensity of the sun at high noon. A variety of goggles and filter devices permit only certain degrees and wavelengths of light to reach the eye. The flash blindness experiment is ready. Below at the control point, other eyes wait.
9, 8,
and watch.
7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.